And I think it's kind of cute that you decided to call the workshop Unraveling. It might as well be called Raveling Dark Matter. But, you know, that's from my point of view where we are right now with this whole business of light wimps and whatnot. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Cogent to start with, but I hope not to spend too much time. Then I'll go into the thick of uncertainty in, you know, all of these searches claiming sensitivity to light wimps, including Cogent. My talk won't be so different from the one I gave at Taupa a couple of weeks ago in that respect. And then at the end, I hope to be able to tell you a little bit about what's going on with Ku as well. And in Ku, we may have observed some anomalies, if that's the way you want to call them. I mean, we certainly know what's going on and what we're seeing, but it was sort of unexpected, and it gives me pause. It also worries me about the future of all these searches. So, as you know, in Cogent, we're using this point contact or P-type point contact germanium detectors. We modified the central contact geometry of a standard, otherwise rather standard germanium detector, and in doing so, we dropped the capacitance of the diode, and with that, a couple of the sources of electronic noise that affect the device. There's four that you can list, and two of them depend on the capacitance of the device. And then when you do that, the threshold or pedestal, whatever you call it, the lowest energy you can detect before you run into the noise from the device is much reduced by about an order of magnitude. We know we can do better than this. And also the energy resolution gets increased because, you know, it's quite a fraction of it is coming from this electronic noise itself. And you start to see all of these peaks. For many years, we suspected there was cosmogenic activity down there. Whenever you see peaks in our spectra, we understand them to the point that it's almost boring. If you actually know the history of exposure of these crystals to cosmogenic activation, to the neutrons, hard neutrons that impinge on them while you're fabricating them on the surface prior to going underground, you can actually predict even the rate of those peaks. This is, you know, stuff that we've been doing for 20 years or so. So anything in the form of peaks, we haven't seen anything that looks like a peak yet that we don't understand. So a few years ago, we started producing dark matter papers using these devices, not so deep. This was just 300 meters of water equivalent, with a detector that also had a lot of internal contamination. There was an enormous patch of indium on its outer surface. But even limited by those sources of internal background, we were able to say a couple of interesting things about DAMA. This gives you an idea of the sort of signal you expect from these light wimps. Clearly, if your endpoint is at about 1.some kV ionization energy, you need something like this. You cannot expect to do the job with a conventional detector. And we impose some limits on light wimps and the super wimps that Maxime Pospelov and his colleagues have been telling us that are actually bona fide dark matter candidates. These devices, and I won't talk about this too much, but these devices have some interesting advantages as well at much higher energies, 2 MeV or so, 2,038 kV, where we look for neutrinoless double beta decay. They're able to, I think it's turning off on me, they're able to differentiate between single site interactions, like those coming from, oh, the big guns. Okay, maybe.
I'm going to ask any questions from the
phone. No,
you're from
me.
Right balance, too. Anyway, in neutrinoless double beta decay, you're looking for a single site interaction. The voxel that gets illuminated by that decay is less than 2 millimeters on the side. And a lot of the backgrounds are coming from higher energy gammas that bang around Compton scatter and give you partial energy depositions at 2,038 kV. So with these devices, we can actually throw those backgrounds out. I think I have removed the transparency that tells you how we do that. But looking at the rise time of the signals, we can tell differentiate this from neutrinoless double beta decay. So we have adopted those within Majorana. Majorana is marching along. We hear that Gerda will also use them in the second phase, and it is quite possible that maybe by next year, Majorana will be taking data underground already. So Majorana has turned into a very interesting light wimp detector. And there's some assumptions on background and threshold we can predict. And there's some backgrounds that we will, in my opinion, we will never surpass. But you can see that we compare well with future searches, but in this lower mass decade. There'll be a targeted detector to look for light wimps. And certainly there's a lot of phenomenologies that populate that that mass region. This is an exclusion plot on super wimps. And there what you are looking for is not an exponential-like distribution of recoils, but the signature from one of those particles would be a peak, an unexplained peak, the rest mass energy of this particle that would then interact via the axial electric effect. We have better limits than this by now. But you can see that with Majorana, we could actually, or the demonstrator, the 60 kilogram demonstrator, we could do a lot of damage there. Now, when we were running already in Sudan, we found another property of these devices that we really like, which is the fact that looking at the rise time of the pulses, we can throw out, this is the cross-section of a hockey puck, and this is a veggie, a P-type point contact detector, which is a slight modification of a commercial device. Anything happening within the first couple of millimeters all around, except for this smallish surface, intra-contact surface, as we call it, anything happening in that surface we can reject. And as you can see, it cleans up the low energy spectrum by quite a bit. One thing we've known all along is our signal acceptance. So, and by signal here, I mean bulk events, events happening in the bulk of the crystal. Okay, whenever you hear me say signal, I'm referring to those fast. If I say fast pulses, I'm also referring to those. And slow pulses, partial energy deposition pulses are happening on the surface, and those would be the background. And what we could identify or characterize from the very beginning just by using electronic pulsar calibrations was this signal acceptance. We impose cuts on our data that allow us to keep 90% of the fast pulses, and we can see that that's the case when we look at these L-shell capture peaks that I will tell you more about in a minute. But one thing we haven't been able to do until now, and I'm going to show you what we're doing in that respect, is to characterize the background rejection. For that, we needed statistics, and we're starting to be able to do a pretty good job. You know, what fraction, when you keep 90% of your bulk pulses, what is the fraction of surface events that you have left behind, the background remaining background contamination? So a year or so ago, we tried to be cautious, but it didn't work. It doesn't matter what you say. People then will decide that you are claiming you're seeing dark matter. We wrote a paper where we said, look, we have installed this detector deeper underground. We have cleaned up the internal sources of background. We are applying these surface cuts. And we're left with a signal that is exponential-like, and there's, of course, nothing exotic about that. Every single low-energy background that you can dream of, it's probably exponential as well. But we are stuck in a place, you know, where there's a lot of action going on. There's gamma without channeling, gamma with channeling, which might bring down their chorizo in coupling. And, of course, new limits for those super wings. And, you know, there was nothing much of interest except for the fact that we were, you know, seeing an exponential-like excess that we couldn't explain away. In a region where phenomenologists predict light wind candidates and where we were too close for comfort to DAMA. At that point, I thought that this would all go away, but then, as you know, we ran into something else. There was this fire in the access shaft to Sudan, and we decided to look at the data we had from the detector at this time. This is in April of this year, I believe, when this happened. And we already had 15 months by then, so we decided to look at the data thinking or hoping or, you know, as a precaution, because there is no warranty that after a thermal cycle to the crystal, we would recover the same performance. And before I forget, and I should mention this later on, I need to tell you that we stayed warm for 3 months. When you warm up a crystal like this after more than a year of it being at liquid nitrogen temperature, it's almost like flipping a coin. Depending on the quality of the vacuum the remaining vacuum in the cryostat, you're either going to find the detector with the same performance when you cool it down again or not. And the news is that we've been running for 100 days, and the detector looks exactly the same from the point of view of noise, baseline. So if the modulation we observed is real and not a fluke, probably by the end of this year we'll be able to take another look and see if it keeps going up and down. So that's fortunate that we don't have to wait to build a larger, newer version of this experiment to see if that statistically speaking, that modulation observed was a coincidence. I mean, at 2.8 sigma, it might as well be, right? But anyway, by monitoring these peaks and using these well-known ratios between L-shell and K-shell capture, you can actually predict what you should be seeing down there. There's no free parameters in this prediction, as you see it here. If you allow this to be a best fit, it's essentially 10% off from the straight up prediction. Then you can assume that you have a flat background, and you know, you end up with a residual that is, again, exponential-like, and of course you can fit a WIMP to that, but it might as well be a background, right? And if you notice, in all of our papers, not only we fit a WIMP to this, but we also allow for the existence of an exponential background. And this region, which has a very precise definition and does not include all of the uncertainties that we know we have, again, ends up uncomfortably close to Dhamma. Dhamma, of course, has a lot of uncertainties I'll mention in a minute, having to do with, for instance, well, is there channeling or not? Channeling would bring this whole thing down. Even partial channeling could, you know, make these things agree very well. This huge horizontal uncertainty comes from the value of the quenching factor, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute, so on and so forth. We're pretty certain about a couple of things about cogen. The fact that the low energy excess is not electronic noise. That's, you know, we're looking for, it's a theory place and you don't have chalk. What's going on here? So
you know where you look for them.
That's a whole box of it. So the signals you're looking for are very characteristic. These preamplifier signals have a rise time that goes, you know, within a fraction of a microsecond to say 3 microseconds, depending on if it is a surface or a bulk event, and then a decay time, which is characteristic of a DC blocking capacitor that we have there. So the pulses that we preserve look like this. You know, when you get close to, I mean, when these things get very tiny, then the fact that you're riding a noisy baseline contaminates your ability to quantify that rise time. And that's what leads to the slow and fast pulses, the bulk and surface pulses, you know, kind of getting mixed up next to threshold. As we improve the noise of these devices, as we plan to do, that will get better and better, or the problem will get bumped to lower energies. And the other thing that we're certain of is the stability of the device. You have read the paper. The noise has been very stable. Now, after the fire, after the thermocycle, the noise looks exactly the same. The behavior of the baseline looks the same. You know, the detector has preserved its properties as far as we can see. And then, of course, we have to do these corrections for those pesky L-shell peaks. That's unavoidable, but as you have seen, we can predict them very nicely. And as you saw, well, you end up with a modulation that shows up for the fast events and, you know, nothing in the surface events, even though there should be 10% of this stuff left behind. Eventually, with more statistics, you might get to see a tiny modulation there. But, you know, that was not expected. What can I say? We'll have a longer paper soon, and you'll see that we have two completely independent analysis paths, and they both generate the same residual events. So, you know, and we have been very good at keeping the two groups working on this working entirely independent from the very beginning. We don't boast about having a blind analysis, but effectively we do have a blind analysis. We, you know, decided what the cuts were before our previous paper, and we haven't touched nor will touch those. This is a month binning, but as you know, people have done unbinned analysis and they come up with the same two. This is one, the energy window in this case is for that region, and that case is for that region, but we have shared this data and people have done all sorts of unbinned analysis. So if you're wondering about the significance of the modulation, Everything I've seen in the literature is from 2.6 to 3 sigma. We claim 2.8 with, you know, an optimized analysis, the simplest thing that we could do. So here's where we roll up our sleeves and we start pointing fingers, right? So clearly everybody's interested in knowing what's going on there, and we got these results from CDMS claiming that there wasn't anything there, you know, lightweight masses. What disgusted me a little bit at first is the fact that they avoided to establish a comparison, direct comparison between the spectra for cogent and CDMS. And I had to take the time to write a pamphlet on this. And as it turns out, they're very, very similar. When you have two targets, I mean, or two detectors, two searches sharing the same target, there's no better indicator of relative sensitivity than just comparing the two spectra. And there's not much sensitivity at all. I mean, not much difference at all. It doesn't matter if I plot these. By now, CDMS has been forced to plot the same thing. They choose to do it instead of in ionization energy, in recoil energy, but it is the same exact thing. Here, I'm actually using their quenching factors, the quenching factors for the CDMS data that they told me to use. And they come up with rather marginal exclusions for these light WIMPs, and in order to arrive to those, they renounce to using all of the detectors. They concentrate on only one detector. They use a very restrictive acceptance region for the nuclear recoils, and they use the Yellin method, which I personally, you'll find me dead before you find me or anyone in my experiments using that method. You call it the optimal gap method for a reason. So they're able to squeeze rather marginal exclusions for, you know, from the detector. I should also emphasize that these two spectra, the cogent and CDMS spectra, you arrive to those through orthogonal cuts. In their case, they cannot reject at low energy surface events, but they can differentiate between nuclear and electron recoils. We cannot do that, but we can reject most surface events, and still you arrive to similar spectra. But they do this by looking at this T1Z5 detector that, if you look at this thesis, Stanford thesis written a couple of years before, this other person within the team looked at the same detector, actually two detectors in common between the two analyses, and for that particular device found 70% larger rate between 2 and 5 kV recoil, the region of interest for this discussion. Okay, and there's no explanation on this. I have been in this business for a quarter of a century by now, which is too long, and I've never seen the situation of giving the data to two people and coming up with a 70% difference. Okay, and for the other, the second detector, they agree within 3%. So you cannot tell me that it's because this other student doesn't know what he's doing. There's clearly a dependence on the choice of cuts, or T1Z5 is not a stable detector. Some people within CDMS are sincere enough to tell you that they're looking into the stability of these devices over time. So I don't know what's going on, but I sincerely don't think that there is, as you heard me say, not only I don't think that there's any real exclusions coming from CDMS, but whatever the cogent is seeing is probably, you know, you have to suspect that CDMS might be seeing a little bit of the same backgrounds or signal or whatever it is. Xenon. Where to start? So this is the very clean exclusion that you see in the papers. This is what I get. I mean, I get the same thing when I adopt the same LF and same assumptions. But when you start looking into all of the assumptions you have made and looking at the different values of LF that have been measured, etc., you actually, if you choose a mass here, you see that you have about two orders of magnitude, if not more, of uncertainty. So, you know, we have to be careful with what we do and make sure that our readers understand that things are not that pristine, okay? There's issues, and Guillaume doesn't know about this, but last night over beers, I was complaining that they sent Guillaume because he doesn't know about this, but he's my favorite person within Xenon. And I'm about to be, you know, since we're here in Petit Comité, maybe we can have a frank discussion, and I'm going to be sort of on the offensive in the next couple of transparencies. But for instance, there are issues with the most recent measurement by Xenon 100 of LF, of the quenching factor for liquid xenon. I hope that Guillaume will be able to tell us more about this. But there are some assumptions made in the analysis that made me worry about the trend for the LF below 6 kV or so. Now, things that bother me is, for instance, this recent update of this analysis of Xenon 100 data, where we're presented with this best fit, who, if you look at the caption for the figure, to all of the existing measurements of LF. Well, you know, that is not true. There's several things that are wrong with this. First, we're preserving, you know, all measurements that are mostly affected by threshold effects that I have taken the time to discuss in yet another pamphlet. You know, this ascending behavior, I don't think that anyone by now believes that it is possible, okay? So we preserve that in the fit. They don't include their own measurement, latest measurement, which is very similar to Mansour. We're assuring the text of this paper that the trend is very much the same, but still it's not thrown into the fit. And, you know, they deny the existence of other measurements done by Zeppelin 3 very recently, for instance, that would bring this best fit down. And what I can tell you is that the low mass exclusions, because I have taken the time to do this myself, are critically dependent on the slope of this thing, critically. So, you know, if we want to make sense of these light wimps, we really need to start coming out clean and doing a balanced job of... Yeah, but this is your update to the paper maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, okay? And then... Yeah. But if you were to introduce your own most recent results, that would bring the best fit down because they're similar to Mansour. Yeah, well, okay, but yeah. But the profile likelihood analysis is what you go around recently in conferences trying to, you know, make us look at. Now, another thing that I've been banging my fist and all the response I get from Xenon is we're working on it. And it's been a year of hearing we're working on it, and I'm kind of bothered by this. Calibrations come before exclusions. You have to understand the response of your detector in the energy region from which you're trying to extract limits for these light wimps. And the last time we saw a direct comparison between expected and observed rates when you put an americium beryllium source of nuclear recoils in front of, in this case, a Xenon 10 detector was a long time ago. And if you look at this presentation, they tried very many different LFs, and consistently, they could not recover an agreement below, say, 10 kV or so. Light wimps, I mean, if you look at a 7 GeV wimp, it deposits a maximum, you know, with very, very small probability, a maximum of about 4 kV recoil energy. So, yeah, but there's like four other plots like this with different LFs, and you know that the conclusions of this talk is we don't know what's going on below. This is but this is why, since the data exists for Xenon 100, it'd be really nice to see this. Because if there is still such a disagreement, then you have to take a penalty on your limits. We do this in KU. In KU, we have a 40% disagreement between the rates we observe and the rates we expect. And we think we know where it's coming from. You're going to see it in our upcoming paper. But still, we fold in the penalty. And it's minor compared with this. Okay? So, you know, we have to start being more careful with all these things. Then there's the Xenon 10 ionization-only limits, where if you look at the history of this energy scale that is extracted from a best fit of a Monte Carlo to an extrapolation of the data down there, it's consistently been crawling that way. You see differences between presentations and proceedings. You know, it's in an entire state of flux leaning, you know, towards the left here. Well, look, no, that's not how the data is going. This is how Peter Sorensen's interpretation of the data has gone. Let's be careful, okay? As I mentioned, two of these lines are the difference between a presentation. I repeat, this is not as data come in. This is just refitting the Monte Carlo to the data in most instances. And as I said, two of these lines are the difference between a presentation and 3 months later a proceedings. I'm keeping a watchful eye on this thing. Okay? And if you shift this by 1 kV, you go from exclusion to, hey, we're seeing something mysterious at low energies. We don't know what it is, you know. So this is I'm an experimentalist, and you cannot do this, okay? You have to calibrate your detector. There's no excuse for this, because there is an old method that was used in germanium years ago that will allow you to establish that low energy ionization scale. It relies on using thermal neutrons. And for xenon, this works. For xenon, there are transitions where you get clean transitions to the ground level, and you produce recoils of the order of 300 electron volts. Okay. And luckily, this gentleman sitting in the front row is now thinking of doing this calibration. But first you calibrate, then you strike limits. Okay. A dose of our own medicine, this is what we did over 2 years at the Kansas State University reactor. We built a monochromatic 24...
threshold.
No.
So you don't need a 300 eV calibration.
Well, a 300 eV calibration will allow you, if Peter is correct, you will see one electron produced every time that you get one of those transitions. If I am correct, you'll see it one every 1,000 times. And what I'm, you know, postulating agrees with what's out in the literature in experiments with, you know, low energy xenon ions on surfaces. Okay, you right now have a clash between your claim energy scale and what's out in the literature by three orders of magnitude in ionization yield. It is big. There's been data taken with neutral, single charge, double charge, xenon, you know, sub-KV, even sub-KV interactions with metallic surfaces, with gold, tungsten, etc. Those data are out there. You can look them up, and you have three orders of magnitude more ionization yield claim in, you know, xenon on xenon. Okay, nobody can do this experiment, this particular experiment with xenon on xenon, but, you know, I don't believe there's anything magical with xenon on xenon. You have to calibrate these things, okay? We took 2 years. We crawled in that reactor bay for 2 years, sucking up a dose before we publish anything on cogent. That's the right order of things. Anyway, we don't have time to go through this technique. But in germanium, we've been very lucky. This is not just, has nothing to do with the quality of the work. It's just that the Linhart theory, which is that line there, it has a free parameter to it. But it seems to fit the existing data very well. This is that point using this technique that we might as well use for liquid xenon these days at very low energies for germanium using thermal neutrons. Okay, so more uncertainties. DAMA has a good deal of those. We don't know, or we didn't know. There was all of this debate about there's channeling or not. Channeling can change dramatically the way you deposit energy when, you know, an ion supposedly streams down the space, a space in the lattice, then it's only losing energy to ionization, and then you go from the usual 20 to 40% quenching to 100%. That was claimed by DAMA and others. And then Graciela, Nassim, and Paolo came up and said, well, you've made a silly mistake there in your initial assumptions. There shouldn't be any channeling. It is true that if you look at their paper carefully in their appendix, there are some models of channeling where instead of getting something entirely negligible, you get about 10%. And that could move DAMA by quite a bit. So we embarked on this studies in Chicago. This is a crystal where you see that arrow there, the manufacturer, we asked the manufacturer to give us a crystal where these two surfaces, opposite surfaces, would be perpendicular to the growth axis of this single crystal. And so in principle, by having a double goniometric table, right here we're looking at Compton scattering, so this really doesn't play a role there. But when we're doing neutron scattering experiments, and we have also done electron scattering experiments, you are in principle able to align the crystal so that if there is planar channeling, you should see some of it. I'll show you the results in a minute. And we have very pretty results. We have been using one of these ultra-bialkali PMTs for the first time for any of these studies in sodium iodine, and that gives us about twice the light yield of any, well, actually three times the light yield from the previous measurement. And that, when you're close to threshold, as I have mentioned before, is golden. And we see all of the, you know, non-linearities in the electron recoil response that have been observed in the literature. We're taking more data, by the way, to have better statistics here. Changes in scintillation decay, everything agrees very nicely with the existing literature. And, well, I might not be so pressed. I'm going to rush. So here's a little bit of a shocker. The quenching factor is going down. I mean, if you look at the collection of all previous measurements, you would be tempted to say, yeah, it's going down, and here it's going down, but, you know, the scale is a bit lower. This difference in scale, part of it can be understood from the fact that none of these measurements before, I mean, the ones that acknowledge these non-linearities in electron recoil, they still didn't fold it into the result. That is not taken into account in this plot. So these things are closer to those points than you would think, a little bit closer, 10 or 15%. But then there's this trend for things to stabilize and to grow. And I claim this is the effect of the threshold, as you will see it discussed in our upcoming paper. So the quenching factor seems to be much, much lower. And I emphasize, this is the first instance of using this brand new ultra bialkali PMTs. And there's three times the light yield in this measurement compared to the latest. That point is, I can tell you, bogus. Okay? So, you know, you go through life picking up enemies, it seems. We have our own share of uncertainties. Fortunately, I mentioned them before. One of them is how much of those surface events we're leaving behind. And now we have the statistics to start to play games and try to figure out, quantify how much of it we have. This is unlabeled and it's not intentional. This is the estimated fraction of fast events left in our spectrum after all cuts. So you can see that right at threshold, this is energy in keV, ionization energy, right at threshold we do have quite a bit of contamination. When you look at when you express this as background rejection, it's not so bad. You have essentially 90% signal acceptance for the bulk events, an order 70% background rejection. And it rapidly goes to perfect separation between the two populations. So here you have an idea of what it does to our cogent blob. The color coding here is the same, so that is some reasonable upper limit to our uncertainty, lower limit, and the best fit. And you can see that it brings things down in coupling and to the right a little bit in wind mass. We are using the template. You cannot do that. We're doing it the other way around. We're using the a template, an energy-dependent template, to pulsar events, which are, of course, fast events. So we're fitting the data distribution in rise time. We're trying to do a fit to the fast event template to extract, you know, this contamination. You'll see it clearly written in an upcoming paper. The template is for fast events, not for surface. You cannot put a source of surface events inside this detector because we have layers of copper, etc. Unfortunately, you cannot. The template comes from a scan using the pulsar, the electronic pulsar, which is a very fast pulse, nominally a perfectly fast pulse in energy. And then we analyze the data in small energy beams, 200 electron volt beams. And then we try to fit to these distributions, you know, to the population of fast events and slow events. Okay? You'll see it properly described in the paper we have soon. So when you do that, well, several things happen, but one of them is here we have already subtracted this flat component, so these data points would sit normally on that. But one thing that happens is that people have been claiming that there might be a little bit of tension between fits to the cogent spectra and fits to the modulation. That really relaxes a lot when you apply this correction, and you end up with what might be a WIMP. That would be the circles here, being pretty close to what Crest is claiming. Now, there's a problem that arises, and the problem is the following. Cogent was observing a modulation in the low energy region that was sort of large already compared to the expectations from a Maxwellian halo, you know, by a factor of 3 perhaps, or 2 to 3. if you apply this correction, that modulation is huge. I mean, if you really want to claim that a WIMP is undulating down there, and suddenly you have lost a lot of the counts that could be coming from that WIMP, you're looking into a fluctuation of the order of plus minus 50%. It's big. Okay, so a Maxwellian halo would not be able to do this at all. And you start to see the tip of the iceberg of my desperation. Yeah. In a background feed that is used in a two-dimensional energy-time analysis. The yellow, it's an exponential background that she left there, that Nicole, the grad student, is. So we always adopt the possibility that there might be an exponential background. Okay. You're going to get the paper will come out soon. And the paper is just a long paper that we've been promising with a lot of details we've been grooming up under the carpet, but we're going to go into this as well. Now, there's lots of uncertainties when you look at just 15 months of data. If you naively separate our data into two piles, summer-like and winter-like, you would say by eye, well, that's about where the modulation ends. But it is true that if you do a more careful job than this, there seems to be a little bit of modulation here as well, as Neil and his colleagues have been claiming, and others too. Neil, for instance, and his colleagues, they've been... Patty, etc. They've been telling us that, for instance, Dama, which is those gray points, and Koyen, the modulations, when you remove the astrophysical uncertainties that I just mentioned, seem to agree pretty well on modulation, particularly if the quenching factor is smaller than the 40% that we claimed for a while. And anyway, there's plenty questions left hanging. But as I said, we're taking data again, and by the end of the year, we'll have two full, yeah. So if you've watched kids play this little game, you will understand why I put it there. So I'm guilty, two of us here in this room are guilty of the serious crime of writing a paper where we say, well, look, you know, there's theoretical prejudice that would tell you that Dama's quenching factor close to the threshold is really 40%, not the claims 30%. And in that case, you see that Cogent and Dama agree very well, so that's fantastic, right? Well, you know, with this correction, we have moved down and to the right, with the measurements that I'm an experimentalist, so I go and I measure this, and I can tell you that there's a fat chance in hell that, you know, that's 40%. No. You see the quality of our data. It's a really nice measurement. So it's somewhere out here. And CREST is there. Okay, so this comfy agreement, in my mind, does not exist anymore, regardless of having written a paper on that. And then you're left wondering, well, you know, maybe those things might be agreeing, but what in the world, why is Dama an order of magnitude higher in coupling, if these things were to agree, as opposed to three independent groups of people hallucinating? Well, one solution would be channeling. And being an experimentalist, again, I can tell you that there is no channeling. We have rotated that crystal. We have the measurement is very forgiving, as you will see. We have even gone 3 degrees this way and that way to see if there was some misalignment. We still want to build another crystal with another manufacturer in case we've been taken for a ride or a mistake was made and the orientation of the crystal is wrong. But the thing is actually to scale, perfectly to scale. Nassim provided us with the right hill peak simulation for this energy. But essentially we align the recoils along that path by rotating this crystal. And you would expect to see the red spectrum suddenly move up to 100% quenching, and there's absolutely no excess whatsoever. So we are going to let the Nassim and company extract from this data an upper limit to what channeling could be, but I can tell you that upper limit is insignificant. I mean, unless we got a crystal that is not oriented as requested, I don't think channeling is there at all. By the way, there's an upcoming measurement of the same from Texas A&M, apparently. So there will be a second opinion on this soon. Then other ways to reconcile these experiments could be this ISO spin violating dark matter. I hope that the motivation is not relieving the tension with xenon, which is the red line there, because I don't think we are there yet. The points here mean I wasn't here yesterday, and I don't know if Neil solved this problem with inelastic scattering or not. So there's a number of other possibilities there that I still don't know about. Then, of course, I think we have several talks today and a couple yesterday that are going to tell us that the local structure of the halo might be actually very complex. And this is what I mentioned before. You expect a very small, and down here, it's even smaller than that. If you take a Maxwellian halo, it's a plus minus 4% modulation, and we're seeing something an order of magnitude larger. Now, the position of gamma in phase space up here is taken from the assumption of a Maxwellian halo, meaning that if Coyent is seeing, allow me for a minute to claim that we might be seeing a wimp that oscillates about, say, plus minus 50%. If something similar is happening in gamma, gamma, or that blob, goes down. So maybe you can blame these things on the structure of the halo. Now, I know nothing about that, as I will claim in the next transparency, but I, as an experimentalist, that's where I start pulling my hair out, because we have too many degrees of freedom to reconcile these experiments. Unfortunately, we don't know enough. And recently I had a conversation with a colleague in phenomenology, and I said, look, I hope you guys, if you're going to start building ad hoc halo models to explain this, I hope that you base that on astronomical observations, on improved simulations, but not on the bias from these experiments. And the response that I got, which at first made me laugh, and then I said, well, maybe he has a point, he said, there's nothing better than measuring dark matter if you want to, build a model for a dark matter halo. But, you know, these are not precision measurements, clearly. That's the message I'm trying to convey today, that, you know, we do what we can, but as you can see, there's lots of uncertainties. Anyway, CRESPS seems to be in good agreement that it is that region, as you saw, with the whole mess. I know nothing about these streams or dark disks, and there are experts in the room. And this, you know, on a bad day, I think about pseudoscience, the fact that we have this infinite number of ways to move things around, because we don't seem to know enough about the halo or the mechanisms of coupling for these particles with our detectors. On a good day, I remain that historically there are episodes of people doing exactly this and generating predictions that turn out to be correct. So maybe we have a weird local halo, at least at high speed. And sincerely, we need to, you know, if the common good is to make sense of this, if light wimps had just been a playground for us to practice our arguing the next time we run in some other mass region into a putative signal, we don't seem to be doing very well when it comes to fairness and absence of bias. I think that, you know, we have to slow down and be a bit more collected. So hopefully there will be, the rumor is that CDMS is doing an annual modulation analysis. They have 10 times the statistics we have in Cogent. At least 4 yearly cycles is about time that they look for this, because the interest in light wimps has been around, as you know, from since 2004. This I mentioned already. We're building, starting to lay the floor in Sudan for this. And last word, last transparency. So another anomaly we have observed, and I use the word anomaly freely here in KU, is we have the dubious distinction of having seen this alpha N background that we have all been putting someplace in the future, but they're here already. We've seen events, single recoils, that we thought might be a wimp until we started to see multiples, until we had enough exposure to see the first evidence for this is not a wimp, this is neutrons, right? And other detectors will have a harder time spotting this. That gives me tremendous pause, because as ugly and, you know, poor man's signature as the annual modulation might be, it's still something rather characteristic. And when we move the discussion to this experiment has seen a handful of events, I am personally going to be left wondering, what is it that you left inside your detector that is giving you this detector-made neutrons, this alpha in neutrons? Okay, so this is the tip of a very nasty iceberg. This is anyway, we have identified our sources. They are being replaced in a month, and probably by early next year, cool, we'll actually be able to tell us a lot about this whole light wind situation. We'll get to see if there's something there or nothing at all. And we have relatively small disagreements between our neutron calibrations and observations in cool. I think it'll be a solid result, whatever we see or we don't see. And I am done, and I'm sorry I went over time.
Maybe a couple of minutes for questions.
What if I tell you, you should mention the steel protection by the very Vulcan, which is supposed to explain the anomalous precession of Vulcan. And it turns out it took 66 years to resolve that.
Don't get me more depressed than I am. Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm curious to listen to these talks today about the structure of the halo, because we better get busy with that, because we have enough of a mess on the experimental side. And if that part of the assumptions is also messy, we really go with the dark.
Are there any questions of non-historical? All right, so we'll move to the next speaker, but let's thank.